Well, many South Africans feel, I'm sure, the way that I feel, that it just is crazy the way that our country has been run of late. So you start off with a situation that you pay your taxes, or worse, you're in a municipality, you pay your rates and taxes there, and you happen to be in a municipality that doesn't work, that is blatantly incompetent people appointed, nepotism rules, they just steal the money, destroy the place, and you got to keep paying your rates and taxes. And you take that to a national level, you do the same kind of thing in paying to government. Now, nobody wants to promote a tax revolt or say, stop paying your taxes. My goodness, you wouldn't want to end up in a South African jail. But what's the solution? Surely there's a solution somewhere along the line. Well, I haven't found one until maybe now. Maybe now. Piet le Roux is the chief executive of SACA-Liga. And Piet, you guys have actually taken this challenge head on. But I think what is most exciting for South Africans generally is you might have a template. And that template is based on, listen, government, if you members of the cabinet, Cyril included, do not take responsibility for what you should be doing, then we're going to sue you in a personal capacity. And suddenly we have action. I mean, it's a heck of a story. It hasn't had anything like the exposure that it should have had. So let's start at the very beginning. You at SACA-Liga don't just write op-eds and tell people what you think should happen. You actually use the tools that every citizen in South Africa has, which is, we're a constitutional democracy, it's a court of law. What brought you to that idea of using the courts of law to actually force people to do what legally they're supposed to?
Well, Alec, we have a quite difficult situation in South Africa, and in many ways, some things are falling apart. And then we thought about, well, given the lay of the land, what levers seem to have a possibility of success? And if you have an executive that isn't doing what it should, and if you have a parliament, a legislature that is putting out bad laws, but you then look at the third element of the state, which is the courts, and you see that that is relatively functional, that the courts like to find in favor of the public interest. We don't always agree with the court findings, but still the courts are by and large much more functional compared to the legislature or the executive. Then you use that lever. And there's the whole idea of a constitution that's been in place since officially in 1996 with some amendments since then. And well, let's test that theory and let's exhaust all the possibilities in the constitution for remedies to state failure. And that's what we apply to many different problems in the country, including a BE or ESCOM or competition policy or other questions, and in this case, a local government failure, local municipal failure. And so the constitution has some provisions, and we thought, well, let's push that to the right to the end and see where that takes us.
And it is interesting because, yes, it is Ditsobotla, what used to be called Lichtenberg, but it appears as though there's a template here that could be used throughout South Africa. So it's not the Ditsobotla story, but that does give us a great example. And let's maybe get into some depth into exactly what went on there. As an outsider, I've seen that they had to rerun all of their municipal elections because there was a disaster. But that's about it. And Helen Zille went up there, and the DA, even with her, could not get more votes. I think they might have got a little bit more votes, but they certainly didn't get more seats. So it is a very interesting reflection of what's happening in South Africa at the municipal level. Just take us through that story.
Yeah, look, Alec, the Tsabotla is a story of people unable to vote their way out of a collapse. And in a way, it's showing that some of the constitutional theory, the whole idea of how to get good reforms in this country, isn't actually working the way it's written on paper. So you mentioned these election results, and I looked them up before this interview. Since the 2000 election, the ANC has hovered around 30, and then recently it dropped to about 16. And where did those votes go to? Well, their vote basically went to the EFF and to some other parties. The DA has consistently had between 4 and 7 votes, and the VF Plus between 1 and 2. So you have a situation where election after election, it doesn't matter how far the town deteriorates, you get the same kind of outcome. Now, this was not, it's not only picked up by us, but recently the MEC of Cocktail Northwest remarked on this when he publicly, this was in about August, he publicly made a plea that the national government should intervene. And during that, he was asked, well, why don't you as a provincial government call new local elections, which is one of the remedies you can. You can disband the council and call new elections. And he just said, look, new elections aren't going to change the result. We're not even considering disbanding the council. We need to scale this up with a national government intervention. And so the first point to note here, we don't have a solution to this yet, but is that local government failure, as it is even as it is spreading around the country, is not going to be solved by more elections. At least not anywhere in the near term. And so this calls for alternative interventions. And this is where our strategy of litigation came in, which we pursued with our partners in Ditsebotla in Lichtenberg, Agri Northwest, and others for several years, going through all the steps that the Constitution provides for municipal failure. The first, Section 139, says that if a municipality fails, then the province should intervene in Section 1395. And then if the province can't intervene or is not successful at reestablishing order, then in Section 1397, the national government should intervene. And this was a multi-year process of litigation to force first the province to fail, to try and then fail, and now to force national government. And of course, national government may very well try its best to succeed. We wish it all the best, and it'll have us our support if it succeeds. But just given its own track record with so much else in the country, it's unlikely that it will succeed. And this is where it's notable what you mentioned, a template or maybe a recipe, Alec, for what others can do. We decided to pick one town and exhaust all the explicit constitutional remedies for municipal failure and see where that brings us. And we're now right at the end of that. And if national government is not successful at reestablishing order and a flourishing municipal governance in that town, that will take us into Terra Nova, into a new territory where we'll have to use a combination of creative jurisprudence beyond what the Constitution explicitly provides for, together with alternative interventions from the business people in the town, from the communities, because the alternative is staying at collapse. And that's going to happen for some towns, but we hope that that doesn't have to happen in Ditsebotla.
And Hermanus is a man from this windy little town called Yaku. Sorry, other way around. Yaku's from Hermanus. Yaku, we need to talk about your upgrade problem.
I don't have an upgrade problem.
Two Audis, an Opel, a Kia, and a Hyundai. It's five cars, Yaku. Denial.
I just love cars. And when we buy cars, that make it so much easier for you and convenient. You sell your car. You want to try it?
Okay, just once. Turn off the cameras.
I see how this is addictive.
Take two of those. We buy cars. The easiest way to sell your car by far.
So let's just understand this a little better. Here in South Africa, we have apparently wonderful laws. But we also know for sure that many of the wonderful laws are not being applied. And what you guys are doing, and in particular in this case, taking it as a test case, is that you are now applying the laws as they are on the statute books. In other words, you're not doing anything illegal. You're not deviating from the way it should be, but hasn't been for a long time.
Yeah, Alec, the constitutional provisions are there. And so let's test them. If they are there for a reason, then when the circumstances arise, test them. And that's what we're doing. We're exhausting them and in the hope that it will render success. But if it doesn't, then, well, we must be looking at alternatives. The litigation route is not the only thing that I think should be used in a strategy like this. We've contributed that. But the businesses in this town and the ratepayers have also got together, and they've started something called the Local Services Association, the Ditsebotla Services Association. Now, it's more difficult than it sounds, but what this Services Association is attempting to do, and has done so with success for the past year, 18 months or so, was to assist businesses and ratepayers in the town to systematically use the provisions of municipal governance and municipal finance to lodge formal disputes with the municipality. Because in towns like these, Alec, you don't even get a rates and tax invoice or bill anymore. The municipality has no clue what you're supposed to owe. So it makes up numbers about what your electricity bill is due or what your refuse is or what should be your bill should be or your water services bill. And you get these random accounts from time to time, or you get nothing, or you just get your water cut off because you haven't made some kind of payment. And it becomes a complete chaos. So I think in combination to the litigation strategy that we've pursued with our partners there in Ditsibotla, I think a key is also to form some kind of services association, some kind of ratepayers association that assists each other in using properly the provisions under local government legislation to lodge formal disputes, because that protects you when the government comes, or the local government comes and tries to cut off your electricity or cut your water because you were supposedly didn't pay your rates and services. Because you have to, at the same time, even as the litigation strategy pursues, you pursue it, that you have to also throttle the flow of finances to corrupt and useless government officials. So if you just keep paying anything at every demand of the municipality, then you're just fueling a bad system.
But central government wasn't terribly keen to take up its responsibility. And from what I understand, you had to threaten Ramaphosa and the cabinet.
Yes, we had to go through multiple rounds of litigation, including very strenuous threats in earlier versions of this litigation against the provincial government. Most recently, what happened last week was that we finally got a court order that just sealed the whole deal. And the court order says, we are noting now that national government is intervening. National government, by name, the Minister of Finance, Gorongwana, he has to report to Saakalikha every 3 months with a report on the intervention. We will make that report available to the people in the Ditsibotla in Lichtenburg to monitor the situation and consider their further options. But and we got a cost order. So basically all the costs, we're recovering a big chunk of it. Now, that's the end of it. This court order just sealed it. But the intervention came about 6 weeks to 2 months ago, only after we threatened the president, Ramaphosa, Minister Gorongwana, and Minister Klabisa of local government, when we threatened them with personal cost orders in case they do not now take up their obligations to intervene under Section 1397 and national government intervention. And that was after even the provincial MEC for local government, Uaheng Molapisi, made this public plea that I mentioned earlier, where he said, please come, national government needs to intervene in Ditsibotla. Now, this is extreme dereliction of duty. It's for months and years, it's clear that the national government is actually obligated to intervene. Cyril Ramaphosa, in the end of 2023, December 2023, he was actually in Ditsibotla. He promised that, you know, within a few weeks, things will be sorted out and there'll be new elections, and all of that came to nothing. And so even since then, for at least 18 months, it was clear, basically by national government's own admission, that they should intervene. They didn't. We then proceeded to this threat of personal cost orders. And I'm sure that their legal advisors informed them that the chance of our success with those personal cost orders were very high. And Alec, it's, sometimes people tell us, you know, why don't you just ask personal cost orders all the time? We'd very much like to, but there's a very high threshold in courts of law for awarding personal cost orders. And so that has to be crossed. Only in extreme dereliction of duty, you actually cross that threshold. And we were at that point about 3 months ago when we made those threats. And then within, I think, 3 or 4 weeks after that, the national government, they initially just acknowledged receipt of our threat. And then a few weeks later, they announced and cabinet made that decision to intervene. And since then, the Ditsibotla has now been under national government, directly under the responsibility of cabinet. They've appointed a national cabinet representative to run the show there. And this jury is still out on where that's going to lead. But unfortunately, that's what it took to get national government, the president and his cabinet, to take up their responsibility. Unfortunately, the threat of personal cost orders, which they then acceded to basically on the steps of the court.
They must hate this, because now there's a little in their minds gadfly called Ditsibotla, which is now taking a lot of their attention when they've got these huge responsibilities like the G20 to take care of. But it has focused the minds. And I guess the next question is, are there other municipalities that are in a similar situation, which we know yes, and would you be able to use the precedent that has been created now in this town to apply it elsewhere.
A quick anecdote, Alec. When I was at the Black Business Council, I was invited to be a speaker at their annual gala event 2 or 3 years ago. And I shared the stage with Minister Gorongwana. And we had not met before that time personally. And so I walked up to him and I introduced myself. And at the moment I mentioned Saklikha, I could see that he immediately recognized that. And he said, you guys are litigating against us. And I said, yes. And, you know, I'm at the Black Business Council and I'm discussing, we had a quick big victory on against procurement BEE at that point. And that was the topic. So I thought that was what he had in mind with litigation. He was a respondent in that case. And I said, yes, Mr. Gorongwana, we are litigating, but we think that BEE is really harmful, and we're going to litigate until it's away, or we're not going to stop until BEE is gone. And he said, no, not about that. I'm talking about the Ditsobotla, the municipalities. And so it was just at that moment I realized that the specter of being the Minister of Finance responsible for 200 failed municipalities is actually more daunting to him than the challenges we're raising against BEE. And this brings me to your question, Alec. You're asking, well, what's next if other municipalities also, if the same happens there? We don't intend to litigate municipality by municipality to make this happen. But we have demonstrated that it is possible to follow this process. We think it can be done. We did it in about 4 years, but you know, the road's been trodden now, or the track's been laid. So it's possible for others possibly to do this more quickly. And we suspect that other municipalities will also progress to the national, to the level of national government intervention. It has happened under other circumstances in places like Standerton, I believe. But this is the first one where end to end, we took it from the beginnings of Section 139 all the end to national government intervention. And now that that's established, we are going to shift our focus into thinking about how do we assist businesses and business formations in these towns. We're setting up alternative administrative mechanisms, alternative service and common infrastructure maintenance programs. It's not clear how that can be done, but we know it must be done. And repeating this litigation process elsewhere for Saklikha is not a good allocation of our resources. We're going to have to focus our attention on what to do once national government intervention is not successful. But there is definitely scope for local business entities, other organizations. We're happy to share all the papers, all the paperwork from the court for anybody's benefit if they want to pursue it on their own. It's just not a good use of our resources. Once we've now proven that Section 1397 can be exhausted, once that is exhausted, it doesn't help to focus on just repeating that. We have to think about what we do if that fails.
Saklikha, you're the state-proofing guys. That's your mantra. State-proof yourself because the state is either, it's not too big to fail. It fails continuously as we have evidenced all over the place. But what happens if, or what happens next once the state intervention either works, let's say it does work, that's the upside, or does not work? What is the next step in this process, which has taken many years to get to where you are today?
I think the next step, Alec, involves two things. The first is, and this is nascent, so I can't speak in too much detail, but we have to understand that local government collapse means that no one's accounting for this, for the use of common infrastructure and common services and common maintenance in the town. And so you can think maybe it's wonderful a business doesn't receive a utilities bill. But the problem is if no one is accounting for the shared use and the proportional use of common infrastructure, common services, and no one pays for that proportional use, then those things cannot exist. They will fall apart. And so I think one of the first steps will be the introduction of parallel administration, parallel accounting for who uses what in the town and who owes what. And there's no reason why businesses can't do that in parallel. How that then translates into getting everybody to contribute is another step. But businesses generally are willing to pay for the services they use. They just don't want to put it into a black hole where it gets stolen or not used for the maintenance of those services. Now, there are interesting precedents in towns like Frankfurt, where organizations like Rural Maintenance was appointed on a long-term contract to manage some of the electricity infrastructure in that town, where it's been proven, it's different circumstances, but it has been proven that private service providers can do proper accounting of who uses what and can get almost 100% payment from the community for those services. So I think we'll have to look at experiments and alternatives like those. So first is parallel administration, or a parallel sort of accounting, record keeping. And then after that, which is already in practice happening, we see some businesses there, they buy the cables for, an electricity cable gets blown or gets stolen, or pipes gets burst, water pipes. And then the local businesses in those towns, the agriculture and the other businesses, it's quite common. They just buy the parts, they give it to the municipality, and under their supervision, it gets installed. And it's going to be a little bit messy, but that has to be extended into more formalized arrangements where you have some kind of understanding between the municipality, who has some kind of nominal governance role, and the business community, which has the executive capacity. And between them, over time, this understanding must strengthen. And as the power relations shift, we'll see more and more leverage from the side of businesses able to exert their prudence in the maintenance of common infrastructure and record keeping and so on. So that's what's going to happen in practice. We see still a role for litigation. Under the Constitution, it's not explicitly for municipal failure, but there is one other provision that we do want to apply and use and test and develop. And that is a principle where it says that in the event that the constitution or legislation does not provide for a problem in society, which obviously there's a gap in law, which we can argue if national government fails is going to be surely the case in Ditsobotla, then the constitutional court is required to make alternative orders that is just and equitable under the circumstances. And so if national government fails, then there is no explicit alternative government intervention. And that takes us into this area where whatever happens in practice and can be done orderly, will invite, we hope, and we will pursue that, will invite the recognition and support of the Constitutional Court. And over time, that'll take us to different modi of how local governance looks like. And it won't look the same in Ditsobotla, it won't look the same in Frankfurt, it won't look the same in Paul, it won't look the same in Emalahleni or Witbank or Polokwane, but that's the way forward.
I guess the question is, this is not brand new, although the latest ruling is, but since national government had its attention drawn to the Ditsobotla responsibilities, has anything happened in the last couple of months? Have you seen any change?
We've had mixed feedback from the townspeople in Lichtenberg. There's been a national cabinet representative appointed, and he's supposedly taken over the responsibilities of overseeing the recovery of the town. There are supposedly teams from National Treasury and others involved in trying to restore administration in that town. Some of the business people give us positive feedback and say some things are happening. Others say it's completely inadequate or there's very little feedback. So it's a mixed message currently. But I think that we're probably looking at 2026 and giving these guys a chance. It doesn't mean that Saaklicha won't be involved. It certainly doesn't mean that there won't be efforts from the local groups, businesses in town to intervene and keep improving things. In a completely failed town, there is a version in which things get turned around quickly, but it's unlikely that we're going to see quick results. I think we need to be a little bit more patient on this. So we don't have a clear indication yet that things are improving, but we're still willing to give it more time.
You mentioned earlier that the Minister of Finance has to report back to Saaklicha. That also can't be something that fills him with great enthusiasm. How so? Was that instructed by the court?
Yes, it was by agreement between the parties that was then made a order of the court. So I think the provision technically is something like that. Every 3 months, the Minister of Finance, Treasury has to compile a report, And that report then has to be provided to us for our insight. And we will then share this with the people in town. I think that's also a good development that other towns that seek to pursue a similar litigation path can consider is in that litigation, try and get the responsible parties to provide its reports to you and possibly to the court as well, so that you just have that makes things easier to litigate if you need to go back to court, and it just gets a version on paper, which otherwise there's continuous dispute. So I have to the credit of national government, they did this by agreement, and that was then made an order of court. But I don't think it's every day that you get orders that tell national government to keep the private parties, entities like Saakeliga, up to date and report to them on progress.
It's quite extraordinary, certainly in the South African context as well. But it does appear as though you may have opened a Pandora's box here. What is happening on the ground, which people know, members of the BizNews tribe know only too well, is that you have people who are, well, there is so much incompetence. There is so much cost to ratepayers and taxpayers. There's so much potential to strip out the waste and the overstaffing and the pure chaos that has been wrought on those who pay. And up to now, those who pay have, as I mentioned in the introduction, continued paying. They haven't really seen an alternative. And I guess that's really what I need you to explore for us. Is this a true alternative? If I'm a business owner in Utrecht, and Utrecht is a disaster, and there's potholes and overstaffed municipality, and the water's not coming through the way it should, and sorry, Utrecht, but I'm using you as an example. What do you then do as a business owner in that town? Do you wait for Saakeliga to ride with the cavalry and get your lawyers to assist, or where do you go to from here?
As much as we would be honored to ride in as a cavalry, we are not going to. It's because we don't understand the local situation, and the solutions always has to come from inside a town. A good place to start would be for business owners, either individually. Let's start with what you can do at the individual level. At the individual level, you can look at what your rates and taxes bills are. Do you get them in time? Are they properly accounted for? And if they're not, lodge proper disputes. Start throttling the flow of finances to the municipality. Don't do a tax revolt. Don't call it a tax revolt, because as much as that sounds appealing, it's very hard to defend that. And in the end, you're going to get your water and services cut off, and it's going to be hard to get that turned on again. And you get all sorts of liability. Try to be smart about it. There are provisions under the Municipal Finance Act and other places which you can use to launch proper disputes and start with not paying what is not properly due to the municipality, and only paying what is properly due. Then I think the second step is to realize that solving a town and solving for town recovery is not an individual endeavor. It's also not a democratic endeavor, in the sense that you need to get everybody in the town involved. People always people tend to say we need to get everybody around the same table. Everybody needs to work together, and actually, that's not how town revival starts. Town revival starts with enough good businesses with enough capital, and maybe one or two or few other people getting around in a small enough group so that coordinated action is possible, and start some kind of local business forum, and then be willing to invest into that forum. Town recovery is not something you're going to get done between 10 and 2 at night after you've already tried and make your business and make your business profitable throughout your course of the day. Try and do division of trade, division of labor. Try and create specialists in your town focused on managing the commons of that town, the town administration, the town recovery. And the way to do that, we think, is to band together as well-capitalized businesses and put money away, appoint someone to make it someone's full-time job to deal with the municipality, think about litigation. in the event of litigation, administer that litigation, negotiate with the municipality, coordinate with other businesses. And that's not that expensive, but it's also not cheap. So, you need to make that investment. We don't think town recovery is possible without coordinated action and investment in executive capacity. And then, of course, litigation is also possible. Like I said, we're willing to share our lessons, but litigation is important. It takes you through the steps of exhausting all the executive remedies in the Constitution. But keep in mind that it's you're actually going to have to develop the authority and influence and new arrangements with the municipality to get involved in the recovery yourself. It's unlikely to come from litigation alone.
But as far as businesses in those towns are concerned, would they be well served by threatening personal liability for errant mayors and errant members of council? Because I guess it's one thing to be driving around in a fancy car that somebody else pays for. It's another thing to be forced to take responsibility for some dumb decisions.
Yeah. Alec, the personal cost orders are very appealing to try and find in litigation, especially where it's so obvious to the community and to you as a litigant that this other party is in gross dereliction of their duty and they are acting in bad faith and so on. But in courts of law, that threshold is actually quite high. And so coming right out of the blocks with the threat of personal cost orders is unlikely to, I think, be successful. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just speaking from my experience working with our legal team. We've just always been advised, and it served us well, to not jump the gun with personal cost orders, but keep them in the pocket for extreme situations, like the case where we did this now with the president and with Minister of Finance, Minister of Cocktail. In the end, they didn't get personal cost orders. The cost orders were in our favor, but because they actually intervened at that threat of personal cost orders, we did not pursue and would not have been successful, likely, in asking for personal cost orders against them at this final stage. So keep that in your pocket as a potential ammunition, but I think don't see that as a golden solution. It's only part of a more comprehensive litigation strategy.
But if you say you might not have been successful, was it just then a card to play? Were you never really serious about doing it?
No, we were indeed serious. Look, if President Ramaphosa, Minister Hlabisa, and Minister Gorongwana did not take a cabinet decision and appoint and actually intervened in Itsebotla as they did, I think it was the beginning of October or end of September, they made that decision and they actually intervened. Had they not done so, which was what we told them, then we would bring personal cost applications against them. And that would have been a very strong personal cost applications, and we were fully committed to doing so. We were drawing up the papers for that. But then because they then, in the face of that threat, actually did the intervention, by the time this was heard in court a week or two ago, it would not have been, the court would have said, but look, they actually did what you said. So it would have distracted from the case. And so we were serious, and but they actually did what we demanded. They conceded, they complied with our demands. And Alec, I like it when government, you know, they always insist that we should comply with all of their nonsense regulations, competition commission, all that. This was a case where they actually complied with business. And that's good.
Yeah, we need to have a conversation on the competition commission at some point in time, because that's got very little to do with competition and lots to do with using power to promote ideology. But that's not for this conversation. What is for this conversation, though, is the antibodies will start kicking back. Because if you've got a cushy job, you're doing nothing, you're getting well paid, your alternative is unemployment and poverty, then you're going to be holding on to that council seat or that council position that might have been given to you by a friendly party in the party or in the family. You're going to be fighting that tooth and nail, and it brings all kinds of other complications into it. What defense or what strategy do you have to counter those antibodies?
Alec, I don't think that we are focused at Saakliha trying to fix the municipal election process. You know, this Botla was for a long time had two mayors, had two speakers, and so on. And I think we we don't at Saaklecha, we don't know how to solve that. What it does need reform, but we think that our contribution to that reform will be to build strength outside the municipality and build capability and leverage outside the municipality. And it's a bigger question, Alec, but certainly the way governance is elected in South Africa and the structures and their ability to respond to the actual real world isn't very good. And maybe that's in time, Saaklecha will become more explicit in trying to reform that as well. But for now, our focus is on building strength outside in the civil society among businesses. And that's the antibody strategy at the moment, is being strong enough outside of council to counter the actions of bad actors within council.
Self-determination to a degree. And I just remember, for instance, in Johannesburg, that when OUTsurance would put people at traffic intersections, there was a huge kickback from the Johannesburg Metro that you're taking our jobs. This is our job, even though they could never get people to those intersections where the traffic lights have broken. I think that's kind of moved in the right direction, although we do now have homeless people who are acting as the traffic wardens in those situations. So it really has got to a ridiculous degree. But there's, within the system, there's the antibodies kick back, and they kick back hard against anything that is perceived as threatening the positions that people have. And I guess that's only rational. And that's my question. Within the strategy that you have, you're going to create a parallel, and that's state proofing, a parallel to the state. At some point in time, those who work for the state are not going to be funded by the locals. And it will be interesting to see where that goes. You almost have two groups of people who are fixing the roads, two groups of people who are making sure that the water comes on, and so on.
Yeah, like I think, I get where you're taking this. So two comments there. The first is that litigation will still be useful because it will develop recognition. We hope and we think it can develop recognition for private alternatives and or you can call it public-private interventions. You can give it any name, but interventions from the community side to solve problems like a broken transformer or fixing a cable or fixing a water pipe or common security in the business area and so on. Over time, if there's opposition to that, then I think with litigation, you can carve out better recognition and space for those interventions. At the same time, as much as I don't, and this is a typical, business-like approach, you don't want to wait for permission from the government in order to solve something. At the same time, I think that a prudent strategy for this will be for the businesses of these towns and the communities that support them to try and not wait on government, but also not outrun the local government. There are ways in which you can conclude memoranda of understanding, try and develop good relations, find those within the town's council that actually support what you're doing. So, you know, Alex, sometimes people say we just get rid of politics, just do normal business or just privatize everything. But no society can get away from politics. Politics is getting a bad rap over the years. And today it's almost a swear word to be involved in politics. But actually there is, at a deeper level, and if done right, there's something really ethical, really moral, good about trying to be a good politician. And you don't just have to be a councillor to be a good politician. You can also be a local businessman or a local community member and try and be a good politician, applying wisdom, applying good judgment, applying good relations, and trying to find common ground with others in the community. I think something that won't work is if businesses just go off on their own tangent and ignore the valid concerns and questions from others in the community, including in the council. So the second way to counter the antibodies, besides litigation that I mentioned earlier, the second one is good politics, but just not council politics, politics from the community. And there's no recipe for this. It's just going to require good judgment, good wisdom, good intentions, and lots of patience. But it also has to be part of the solution.
If you look forward now and it does not work, so the interventions don't work, the town councils, the voters somehow decide to even become even more socialist, the town council is then in a situation where they now want to enforce the law. They want to rule with an iron rod. This goes directly, in other words, against your state-proofing idea. I get what you say, and I'm sure many people are kind of saying, yeah, right, what about taxi violence? What about et cetera, et cetera? There's so many power plays that are going on within, especially smaller communities. So what happens then? Where does the state-proofing story go if you get that kind of a response?
And look, there are all through history, some towns and some cities have been destroyed, whether from external threats or from internal division and internal forces. And it's possible, it is likely, and it has actually happened in South Africa that some towns have basically been destroyed. I cannot give you a guarantee that in more towns this won't happen. And sometimes you're correct. In the end, it will turn out that the balance of forces in the town was such that the local council and the nefarious actors within that council could take the council over and was successful in driving all the good actors from the town. But in other towns, and this has also happened throughout history, in other cities, in other towns, in other regions, it sometimes happened that outside of the dysfunctional, nominal governance structure of that area, people found a way to build enough authority and enough power to resist the those clinging to power for their nefarious and sectional ends. So it's not cannot be answered in theory. It can only be answered in practice. In your town, where you are involved, are you going to be able, together with other businesses in the town, develop enough authority and strength and power to resist this encroachment? This is happening across South Africa in many places, but in other places it doesn't. The question is only, is your town going to be, on which side of this are you going to be? And it's not up to Sarklicha to answer that. It's up to the townspeople to answer that.
I can't let you go before drawing the parallels here with the national health insurance. There are certain people who are hell-bent on implementing what any rational brain would say is unworkable, unaffordable, and really becomes another pot for plunder by bad actors. Is there not a case to be made for making them take personal responsibility in the same way as you made the president, the minister of finance, and the minister of COGDA take personal responsibility for the disaster at Ditsobotla? And really what I'm getting to here is what many people in our community that we serve say is that surely you cannot just drive train South Africa over a cliff with no consequences, or at least nobody trying to throw at least some sand in the way.
Yeah, Alec, look, Minister Aaron Motsoaledi and Mr. Nicholas Crisp and others who are driving this national health insurance train over the cliff are people who seem hell-bent on achieving their version of utopia, which will actually be destruction. Now, they are meeting extreme resistance, actually unprecedented litigation resistance. Sarklicha is one of, I think, 8 or 9 entities already having brought a case. And so this is one of those where right now it actually is seeming very unlikely that national government will succeed in implementing NHI. Certainly, they will never succeed in implementing it in its full extent, but they are trying. Now, I don't know if we are yet. This is a legal question that we'll have to ask the legal team. I suspect that their answer will be no at this stage, whether we're at the personal cost order sort of part of this litigation. But we are at other in other ways, I think, giving unprecedented pushback. This is wonderful. It's not only Sarklicha, it's many other organizations with very different approaches, different levels of independence from government pushing back against this, and that's excellent. Beyond the litigation, I think it's very good for people to try and adopt a mindset of maximum achievable non-cooperation. And to the extent that doctors or medical aides or medical services providers or medical equipment providers, etc., are being pressured to kind of assist the implementation of NHI. To the extent that you find it possible, resist that. To the extent that you find it possible that you're not absolutely obligated to comply, don't comply. Find other ways to not compromise. And that's also very good beyond litigation, but just complement our litigation and others' litigation efforts. And Alec, this brings us back to that question of the balance of forces, the balance of power. I think as government fails in so many dimensions, as we see state failure ripple across the country, it doesn't mean the whole country is falling apart, but the capability of the state to actually effect its will, whether it's at a local government level or at a national medical level or at an electricity level, wherever government is failing, a vacuum of power comes into existence. And sometimes I think as much as we may be concerned about those vacuums arising, they're actually in a way a hopeful opportunity, because once there's a vacuum, you don't need to push anybody else. You don't need to push the local council out of trying to fix the water pipe. I think increasingly in future, you can just move in and fix the water pipe. So, Alec, it's a messy future, but for people with a will, people with good political intuitions, for well-meaning people, and for a well-capitalized society like South Africa still is, there is a way out of this, but it just does require an unusual extent of determination and creativeness. And I think it's here. That's why I'm here. That's why Saklifa is here. We think it can be made to work. It's just not going to be the usual thing about expecting the state to recover its capabilities. It's going to have to come from the bottom up.
And it's a little, I suppose, the reference that you made earlier to any businessman. You don't willingly or voluntarily comply. You can say, ek weier. You can say, I don't, I won't. And that this does not make sense. Show me how it makes sense, but do it in a way that is legal, that is civilized, and that will ensure that the other party cannot just apply power that, in fact, it doesn't have.
Minimize your risk in doing so, but don't be an agent of the state. Don't be an enabler of bad policy. To the extent that you can, don't compromise. To the extent that you have to, sometimes businesses have to compromise, do so, but do so to the least required extent, where the demands that are made of you are harmful to society. People sometimes speak about the corporate social responsibility of businesses, and then it means sending money somewhere as if to give back. I think at the most basic level, the core social responsibility of business is to take responsibility for a good environment for business, because that is the material basis from which society can flourish. And so ask yourself, am I compromising on my core social responsibility when some bureaucrat makes this demand of me? If I have to compromise, then do that at the least, the lowest possible level, and then carry on with business.
Piet le Roux is the chief executive of Saklifa. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.